Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I want to begin this course on a positive note by observing that there were periods in history in which men had a serious, authentic respect for logic. Periods in which most educated men, including the leading intellectuals and philosophers, actively wanted to be logical and to have logic on their side. In those eras, the obvious examples are the high point of classical Greece or the ages that we call the Age of Reason and Enlightenment. In those eras, logic was widely recognized as the court of final appeal. There were many disagreements, of course, over particular questions, over whether a particular doctrine was logical or not. But there was no substantial disagreement over the question, should men even try to be logical? Unfortunately, that is not the state of affairs in our world today. A torrent of antagonism and hostility to reason and logic is sweeping the West. It long ago won out in the East and in the communist realm. Today, the attitude of a great number of people is, in effect, logic. Who needs it? Now, the ultimate source of this hostility to logic lies in the torrent of irrationalism unleashed by Kant and dominating the whole course of 19th century philosophy. But the direct source now is the offspring of this 19th century irrationalism, namely the whole array of today's intellectual movements. Contemporary intellectuals are conspicuous for many attributes, but reverence for logic is not one of them. If you look at philosophy, for example, today, on the one side, there are the avowed opponents of reason and logic, the existentialist, Zen Buddhist, Orientalist axis, who claim openly, more or less, that their views are absurd, and appeal to all sorts of special mystical faculties and capacities, allegedly to validate their views. They appeal to their blood, their bowels, their bones, their hearts, their instincts, their intuitions, their moods, etc. To everything except reasoning. Their attitude, the attitude of that whole axis, is encapsulated in a quotation from a follower and admirer of Henri Bergson. Bergson himself was not an existentialist, but he was very influential on this axis. And I'll take a moment to read you this quotation. Quote, "In attempting to describe what we actually know in the abstract logical terms, which are the only means of intercommunication that human beings possess, Bergson is driven into perpetual self-contradiction. Indeed, paradoxical though it may sound, unless he contradicted himself, his description could not be a true one. The object of this book is to show exactly why Bergson must use self-contradictory terms if the explanation of reality which he offers is to be a true one." Unquote. That is about as explicit as you can get. Now, on the other side, there is the branch of modern philosophy which claims to advocate reason and logic, the branch we can call for short the pragmatist, positivist, analyst branch. And what is their viewpoint? Well, that logic is a product of linguistic conventions, that it's a matter of semantics, that the laws of logic are a result of the way people use words, but logic is subjective. Or another variant of this view, logic is simply, it is said, a pragmatic convenience. It's certainly not an absolute. What works today need not work tomorrow. Tomorrow we may have to abandon today's logic and invent a new one. John Dewey, one of the influential fathers of this viewpoint, remarks in his book on logic that Aristotle's logic has worked so well for so long that it is overdue for a change. On all sides, we are told, by this particular axis, logic is arbitrary, it's a social construct, it's a game, etc. A.J. Ayer, one of the leading exponents of this view, states that the laws of logic are true, quote, simply because we never allow them to be anything else, unquote. In other words, they express our linguistic usages. They remain true so long as we want to use words that way, but of course we're free to change. Wittgenstein, the real father of the analyst movement, encapsulates this view in one pregnant aphorism, quote, "The propositions of logic all say the same thing, namely, nothing," unquote. His point being they are empty, they have no tie to reality, they simply express linguistic conventions. This is the kind of choice that modern philosophy offers. Is logic false and to be shunned, or is it an empty, subjective, social game divorced from life and from reality? Which means, in essence, is logic wrong or is it useless? Now, if this is the choice that people are given, it is hardly a surprise that disdain for logic, antipathy to logic, seeps into and permeates virtually every area of the culture today. If you want an example, look at art today, if you can. And of course, it will be clear to you that art long ago became the domain of the irrationalists. Virtually everyone concedes logic is antithetic to art. It's inapplicable to art. Or try something else. Try and speak in favor of logic, and the first question you will be asked is, well, what about emotions? What about man's innate irrational instincts, the Freudians will ask? What about love? Just about everyone will ask, including most psychologists. That is to say, I amend that, I refer only to the psychologists who take enough time off from the study of rats to reach such a concept as love. Logic is irrelevant, even harmful to education, say the progressive educators. We don't want to stuff our children full of formal proofs. That's dry, abstract, irrelevant, uninteresting to the children. Besides, they add, it breeds absolutism. Proofs give the child the illusion that he can know something with certainty. And besides, they add, it's antisocial. We must teach children to adapt to the views of their peers in the community. The proper model of education, I've been told by an advocate of this view, is not an independent mind reaching its conclusions by rigorous logic, but a group of students sitting on the floor with the teacher, voting, in quotes, democratically on how much 2 and 2 is. Meanwhile, say the politicians and the social theorists, and I have in mind here preeminently the conservatives, we have to be careful of logic. It's very dangerous. Russia, they say, is an example of a strictly logical, scientific social system. The American way of life rests on faith in God, and we mustn't upset it by too great an injection of logic. Even science today, the last bastion of reason and logic, is giving progressive signs of disintegration under the weight of the accelerating irrationalism. As one simple example, which many of you undoubtedly have heard, many noted scientists today say that the phenomenon of light, which displays some characteristics of being a wave phenomenon and some of being a non-wave phenomenon, proves that the laws of logic are not applicable to reality, and the conclusion they come to is that simply is the answer. Light is and isn't a wave, period. And so it goes in one area after another. Now, the effect of all of this, I've just hit a few high points, on the general public is incalculable. The public is unaware of the technical minutiae of the philosophers, but it absorbs the general implication of this torrent of anti-logic views. And so people begin to wonder if logic is inapplicable to all these crucial areas of human existence, what is it good for? If logic is just a subjective construct, why should we adhere to it rigorously in our thinking? If logic is just a social convention, why can't we abandon that convention when we feel like it? If logic is arbitrary and irrelevant to life, then who needs it? Now, since this is a course on logic, we better begin by answering this question fully and firmly at the outset in order to lay the base for the entire subject. Let us therefore ask right now, why does man need logic? What is the role of logic in human cognition? Why is it necessary? Why should a man be logical in coming to conclusions? Why should he employ any such method as logic at all to validate his ideas? Why can a man not validly accept as true any arbitrary idea which floats through his head and which he happens to believe? Why can't he accept it just because he believes it? Now, in answer to this question, you must cite two basic facts. One of them from the branch of philosophy known as metaphysics. In other words, the fact pertains to the nature of reality. The other from the branch of philosophy known as epistemology, which is the theory of knowledge, and this fact pertains to the nature of human consciousness. It is the conjunction, the combination of these two facts that gives rise to the need for such a method of validation as logic. And let us take these two points in order. The first, the metaphysical point, is what objectivism refers to as the primacy of existence. In essence, this means that that which exists, the world, reality, existence, is what it is, independent of the content of any consciousness. Facts, existence, have metaphysical primacy. They come first. They set the terms. They are there. They are real. They are independent of any mind or consciousness. And consciousness, on this primacy of existence view, is nothing more than the faculty for grasping what is antecedently out there, what antecedently and independently exists. Consciousness is simply the faculty of perceiving, grasping, identifying, coming to discover what is out there. That is the primacy of existence viewpoint. The alternative view on this question is called the primacy of consciousness. That would mean that existence was in some sense a byproduct, a creation, a derivative of consciousness. That facts are not independent of people's beliefs, their wishes, their hopes, their dreams, their yearnings, their aspirations, their titillations, etc., but are in some way that facts are created by or derivative from this host of mental phenomena in some way. So that on this sort of view, for instance, if a man believes some idea, that sheer act of his consciousness, the act of believing it, would require that the corresponding fact come into existence. On the primacy of consciousness viewpoint, to put it colloquially, consciousness sets the metaphysical terms. It comes first. It is the primary, and existence simply snaps into line accordingly. Now, if the primacy of consciousness metaphysics were true, there would be no need for any special method for a man to validate his conclusions. The sheer fact that he believed an idea would then be sufficient, because the belief would create the corresponding reality. Now, the primacy of existence is an axiom. According to objectivism, it's the basic philosophical axiom, but this is not the place to go into a discussion of its ramifications. I simply want to observe here in passing that no proof of the primacy of existence is required in this or any other context, because it is the presupposition of any rational discussion. If somebody says to you, prove the primacy of existence, his demand is based on the premise that your sheer belief in it is insufficient. And why is your belief insufficient? If you press him, he must finally say, because after all, facts are what they are, regardless of what you think. So if you hold a certain view, you have to prove it. And in other words, he has to rely on the primacy of existence even to demand an argument in favor of it. So that we take simply as a fundamental axiom. And that is the first point why a method of validating one's conclusions is required. Because existence has metaphysical primacy, because it is what it is, independent of consciousness. Now there is, however, a second point to understand why logic is required. And that is that when human beings enter the realm of thinking, the realm of conceptual cognition, they are fallible. They are capable of error. They are not automatically correct. Now, this is not the same point as the preceding, because even if you grant the primacy of existence, it doesn't follow that every consciousness, regardless of its means or form of awareness, must be capable of error. For instance, in the case of species whose only means or form of awareness of facts is by direct sense perception. In the case of such species, obviously their knowledge is enormously limited, but as far as they go, they are incapable of error. I'm thinking obviously of animals. Now they have no need for logic, nor for any validating method, even if they could understand the subject. An infallible consciousness would not have to validate its content. That it has a certain content is sufficient, because being infallible, it can't go wrong. But human knowledge is essentially conceptual, and as such, it is obviously not infallible and not automatically correct. Now, many of you will recognize that the deeper point involved here is that human consciousness is volitional. Man has free will, and that is the basic reason why human consciousness is not automatic and not automatically correct. Now, if you combine these two points, the metaphysics of the primacy of existence with the fallibility of a volitional, conceptual human consciousness, you will see why a method of validating one's conclusions is required. You're trying to know existence, to learn facts. And facts are what they are, independent of your consciousness. And the sheer fact that you believe something doesn't show that it corresponds to those independent facts, because you are fallible and capable of error. Well, under those conditions, if you are to be able to claim any idea of yours as knowledge, you need to have a standard by which to judge its truth. A standard to enable you to determine whether or not a given view you hold is true or not. You need some method to enable you to determine how to arrive at reliable conclusions, when you can claim that they represent facts and when they do not and are to be rejected as false. To summarize, if a person's conclusions were automatically infallible, no appeal to any validating standard or method would have any point whatever. Logical validation of a conclusion in such a case would be entirely superfluous. A validating standard or method is required only because you're trying to know the facts of existence by conceptual means, and the sheer presence in your mind of an idea is irrelevant as to whether or not that idea is correct or true or corresponds to reality. This is the fundamental theoretical reason why man needs to employ a method such as logic. If I condense it all into one sentence, I'd put it this way. Logic is the method by which a volitional, non-automatic consciousness can ensure that its content corresponds to the facts of an independent reality. Did I say that once more? Logic is the method. This is not yet a definition. Logic is the method by which a volitional, non-automatic consciousness can ensure that its content corresponds to the facts of an independent reality. This is why, as a matter of philosophic theory, man needs a method such as logic. Now, there is no conflict between theory and practice. Precisely because logic is the method of keeping man's consciousness in contact with reality, the exercise of logic is the absolute precondition of a man's successful achievement of any value, whether we speak on an individual or a social level. To achieve a value, one must act in reality, which means that one must know the facts one is dealing with, which requires a process of logic. Consider a few obvious practical examples. Take material prosperity. What is the role of logic? The answer is obvious. Remember the Dark and Middle Ages. Those were the centuries when men turned against logic on a vast social scale, when faith in revelations and a wave of illogical superstitions replaced reason. You could take as the symbol of the mentality of that era the famous early church father Tertullian, who uttered his manifesto against reason in the words credo quia absurdum. It was in regard to a certain doctrine of Christianity, and he answered, I believe it because it is absurd. It is certain because it is impossible. This was his way of showing he was having no truck with reason and logic. Now, if you project an era dominated by that mentality, as in essence the Dark and Middle Ages were, you would not be surprised that the results were grotesque poverty, stagnation, brutality, a fantastically low life expectancy, mass illiteracy, and waves of insanity which struck whole towns. A simple comparison of the conditions of life before and after the Renaissance should make clear the role of logic in human life. And of course, nothing else was possible during the Dark and Middle Ages. If men abandon the method which keeps them in contact with reality, obviously they will be helpless to function successfully in reality. Take another practical issue, the question of political freedom. What role does logic play in securing that value? Well, consider the fact that every totalitarian dictator, without exception, conducts a campaign against thought and specifically against logic as a precondition of his rule. If he can undercut the concept of logic in his victims' minds, he has thereby in one stroke wiped out their intellectual independence. He's made it impossible for them to question, to challenge, to argue. He has destroyed their method of thought, severing the connection between their minds and the facts of reality. And the resulting void is his to fill. The dictator's utterances replace reality, his revelations replace facts, and his subjects are reduced to docile, obedient, intellectually helpless zombies, to the precise extent that they do abandon logic and thought. So, for instance, it's not an accident that the communists preach a view of reality according to which it's run by an incredible dialectic process. The relevant point for our purposes being only that this means that in their view and according to their ideology, reality is filled with contradictions, and nobody was wronger than Aristotle. The leading communist theoreticians are fully aware of the political purpose of such an assault on logic. Or here, take another example. Who said the following? Quote, at a mass meeting, thought is eliminated. And because this is the state of mind I require, because it secures to me the best sounding board for my speeches, I order everyone to attend the meetings where they become part of the mass whether they like it or not. I mingle the people. I speak to them only as the mass, unquote. The idea being then, you see, that the capacity for thought is supposed to be suspended in an orgy of mob frenzy. That is Adolf Hitler, who consciously, I may say, took his cue in this respect from the Catholic Church. Quote, this is from Hitler, "The church has realized that anything and everything can be built up, no matter how contradictory or irreconcilable. The faithful will swallow it whole so long as logical reasoning is never allowed to be brought to bear on it," unquote. That speaks for itself. Or consider as a last example the issue and the value of mental health, including personal self-confidence. Now here I think the role of logic is obvious. A healthy, confident consciousness is one attuned to the facts of reality, a state possible only to a mind which is scrupulously committed to logic. A man cannot trust his mind. He cannot achieve a state of self-confidence or self-esteem if his ideas are a whole mess of contradictions accepted by whim, emotion, social pressure, etc. If he accepts his ideas by some bizarre combination of to him unknown factors, obviously he cannot trust his mind or his conclusions. You cannot trust your conclusions unless you have got good reason to trust them. And the only reason is that there are good reasons for holding those ideas. In other words, that your ideas pass the test of logic. So much for a statement at the outset of the role of logic in human life, in theory and in practice. You can look at it this way. Reason, the faculty of reason, is man's basic means of survival. Logic is the method of using that means. The method of using that means. Now let us build up a definition of what logic is. To begin with, the first point I stress is that the principles of logic must be based on the facts of reality. The principles of logic cannot be open to arbitrary human choice or subjective social whim. To use a technical expression, they must be ontological, O-N-T-O-L-O-G-I-C-A-L. Which is roughly synonymous with metaphysical, but it happens to be the word philosophers use in connection with this issue. When you say that something is ontological, you mean it pertains to reality. Now, I want to stress this right at this point, because I want you to see at the outset that all the modern schools of logic that I referred to earlier, they call themselves non-ontological schools. That is, they hold that the laws of logic do not reflect reality. I want you to see at the outset that all of those schools are invalidated out of hand. It is not necessary to argue against the pragmatists and the positivists and the analysts and to go into the details of all those variants. The whole business is false in principle. Why? Well, if you understand our discussion so far about why logic is necessary in the first place, you'll see immediately why only a logic based on reality has any function or role in human cognition. Go back to why a standard such as logic is required. Remember the points, the primacy of existence and the fallibility of a volitional consciousness. And now ask yourself, if this is why a validating standard or method such as logic is required in the first place, then what fundamental condition must it fulfill if the standard is to be able to perform the function for which it's required? And the obvious answer is the standard must be derived from the facts of existence. The principles of our validating method must be facts of reality. In other words, the basic laws of logic must be ontological, must be facts of reality. If the standard were not derived from existence, if the principles of our validating method did not represent facts of reality, but were simply arbitrary creations or products of man, not dictated by facts, not corresponding to facts. If, in a word, the principles of logic were not ontological, then the whole appeal to logic as the standard would be pointless. Then the whole demand for logical proof would simply become irrelevant and unjustified, because then you would have no grounds to assume that adherence to the principles of your validating method would enable you to conform your thought to reality. In other words, in such a case, the whole employment of logic becomes irrelevant to human cognition. Now, that's abstract. Let me give you an extreme but concrete example to illustrate this point. I'm happy to say that no philosopher that I have heard of has yet come up with this particular version, but I expect it momentarily. Suppose a person were to adopt what we can call a matriarchal theory of logic. Suppose he were to say the following: man is fallible, he needs a standard. Before you can accept a conclusion as reliable, you must therefore validate it by reference to a certain standard, a standard determined by and emanating from my mother. If my mother likes your idea, it's true. If not, it isn't. So if he were defining logic, he'd say it's the process of identifying facts in accordance with his mother's preferences. And if he published in the journals, he would say the laws of logic are not ontological but matriarchal. Now, if you deigned to speak to such an individual, you would answer with some exasperation, "Look, the reason that I need a validating method such as logic is that I am attempting to know the facts of existence." And you would ask, what reason in the world is there to assume that if I adhere scrupulously in my thinking to a method based on your mother's subjective preferences and test all my conclusions rigorously by this method, they will be any more reliable, any closer to actual fact, than if I just dispense with the middleman of your mother and her method altogether and accept anything I feel like arbitrarily? In other words, why not then just revert to the initial situation and accept anything and everything blindly, which is the very situation from which I'm trying to extricate myself? Now, this seems preposterous, this example of the matriarchal theory. But in principle, the situation is not changed one particle. If you say, well, I'm democratic, I don't make it just my mother, but everybody's mothers, and I toss in their fathers and uncles and second cousins too, in other words, society. And if you make that the validating standard or generator of logic, you have the same situation as if you just took your mother. Now, to sum up, the purpose of a validating standard such as logic is to enable us to determine when our conclusions represent facts and when they don't. To enable us, if we rigorously adhere to it, to ensure that our thought will conform to the facts. Only a standard that is itself derived from the facts of existence can perform this function. Only a method whose principles are facts of reality can qualify as validating. In other words, only an ontological logic has any point, any validity, any authority. Any other kind of logic is in the same category as the matriarchal type. So you can dismiss without a qualm all of the non-ontological theories of logic. Whatever they're talking about, it is not logic. All right, now our question is, well, which facts of reality can serve as the basic principles of logic, as the principles at the base of our validating method? And the first point to see is that the facts in question must be universally applicable to every subject matter, because we are looking for the principle of a method which will guide us no matter what subject matter we're considering, past, present, future, mental, physical, shoes, ship, cabbages, rich men, poor men, beggar men, thieves, art, love, politics, astronomy, you name it. So we need then a fact or a principle inherent in everything which exists. A principle inherent in the nature of existence as such, so that it will therefore be true of everything which exists. Or if we use Aristotle's famous expression for this, we need a principle which is true of being qua being. Being qua being. In other words, of everything which exists simply in virtue of the fact that it exists. Now, the principle we are seeking was, of course, first discovered, although it wasn't named as such, by Aristotle, the greatest of all philosophers and the father of logic. To this audience, I'm afraid I cannot build up any further suspense as to what it is, although in classes at school you make a production of it. But you, I know, are already familiar with it. I mean, of course, the law of identity. Everything which exists is something. It has a nature. It has properties which make it what it is. It has an identity. It is what it is, or put it in symbolic terms, A is A, where A stands for anything. The universe is the universe. A peach is a peach. A genius is a genius. A dream is a dream. The law of identity is the fundamental law of reality. Insofar as your thinking is in accordance with the law of identity, it is in accordance with reality. Insofar as your thinking departs from or conflicts with the law of identity, it departs from reality and invalidates itself. So at this stage, we could say logic is simply the method of thinking in accordance with the law of identity. But now we have to be more specific. What does thinking in accordance with the law of identity consist of? How do we know when we are or are not in accordance with it? To which question Aristotle said, there is one fundamental type of error by which men can violate this law. One fundamental sin in thinking which we must shun if we are to adhere to A is A. And that is, we must never hold about anything that it is A and non-A. We must never hold about anything it is and it isn't. Or to use the term that's of course widely known for this, we must never hold contradictions. A contradiction would be a claim that something is and isn't so, that something is A and non-A. Now, what is wrong with contradictions? And the answer is, if you hold a contradiction, you deny identity to the subject matter you are discussing. A contradiction is a violation of identity. Now, the simplest way to see this is the example I often give to students who are very concerned with the grade they're going to get in the course. So I tell them, consider this example. You've just written your final exam and I've graded it, and you ask what the grade is, and I say, you've got a grade of 75. And the student sighs with relief that he passed respectably, and I say, but I left out one thing. Your grade is also not 75. Now he's baffled. And the first thing he says is, well, you mean you graded the paper twice, and the first time it was 75 and the second time it wasn't? I said, no, I only graded it one time only. And it was both 75 and it isn't 75. And he says, well, you must mean from two different perspectives in two different respects. Like if you use one set of standards, it's 75 and the other not. Now I say, no, the same time, the same respect, the same standards, everything the same. It is and it isn't 75. Now the student says, perfectly logically in such a case, but then I didn't get any grade at all. this 75 annihilates the non-75, and the non-75 annihilates the 75, and you may as well have said nothing whatever. You gave me no grade. My grade has no identity. And that, of course, is the point. The point is, a contradiction is a violation of identity. And therefore, when we say you cannot advocate contradictions, the ground for that is simply everything which exists is something. We can, therefore, restate the law of identity, now for specifically epistemological purposes, in the form of a law which will guide us in all our thinking. And that's what Aristotle called the law of contradiction, sometimes called the law of non-contradiction, but it's shorter without the non. And the law of contradiction states simply nothing can be A and non-A. Nothing can be A and non-A. But now here you have to add two qualifications, which were not needed for the law of identity, but are needed for the law of contradiction. You have to say nothing can be A and non-A at the same time. Because obviously, for instance, a table could be red on Monday, and then it could be painted and become non-red on Tuesday. But at the same time, it can't be red and non-red. And you must also add in the same respect. Because obviously, even at a given time, the top of the table could be red and the side or the bottom could be non-red. But if you specify the time and the respect, then it cannot be A and non-A. And thus the law of contradiction simply says nothing can be A and non-A at the same time and in the same respect. Now this, as I hope I've made clear, the law of contradiction is not a different fact from the law of identity. It is a restatement of the law of identity. It is the law of identity in a form calculated specifically to guide human thought. Now, according to Aristotle, the law of identity, specifically in the form of the law of contradiction, is the fundamental law that governs all valid thinking. Take, for instance, the classic Socrates syllogism. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. That's a perfect little example of reasoning. Ask yourself why the conclusion follows. Let me take a moment out here to give you three terms, which we'll be using all the time. Premise, conclusion, inference. The premise, or premises of an argument, are those facts that you allege as the basis, the evidence, the grounds to justify what you're trying to prove. In the case of the argument I just gave you, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, those two statements are the two premises. The conclusion is the thing you are trying to prove, the fact you want to establish. In this case, Socrates is mortal. And then there is the term inference, which is the process of drawing the conclusion from the premises. You are said to infer the conclusion from the premises, and inference you can define as the process of passing in thought from premises to a conclusion. Now, just with that terminological background, all of those terms I'm sure are familiar to you. Taking this Socrates syllogism, ask yourself, why does the conclusion that Socrates is mortal follow from those premises? And there is only one answer, because if you came to the alternative conclusion, you would be committing a contradiction. You would be saying the following. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is not mortal. And that would mean all men are mortal, and here's one who isn't. Which would be something is so, and it isn't so. It is, and it isn't. It's A, and it's non-A, which is a contradiction. Now, you may never have heard the formal statement of the law of contradiction before, but it is your implicit, if not explicit, knowledge that a contradiction is simply impossible, that no such thing can exist in reality, that impels you, as soon as you hear all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, to say, well, then he must be mortal. And the source of that must is the recognition of the fact that a contradiction is simply impossible. Reasoning, therefore, according to Aristotle, is simply the process of observing certain facts, which are your premises, and then, directly or by implication, consulting the law of contradiction, and then drawing the conclusion that is necessitating. So we can say that logic is the art of thinking non-contradictorily. And just one further refinement, so you will understand the objectivist definition of logic, I simply have to add that thinking, according to objectivism, is a process of identification, a process of discovering what some subject matter is, of grasping the nature or the identity of some set of facts. And with this, you can now understand Ayn Rand's definition of logic as the art of non-contradictory identification. That is true of every type of reasoning, as we'll see, whether deduction or induction. Now, the laws of identity and contradiction are not the only laws of logic. There are many others. But they are all reformulations, ultimately, of the law of identity. One in particular, however, I want to call your attention to, and that is what is known as the law of excluded middle, formulated and named by Aristotle. And the law of excluded middle states everything is either A or non-A at a given time and in a given respect. Everything is either A or non-A at a given time and in a given respect. A man is either a genius or he is not at a given time, because he might develop the ability later. And in a given respect, he might be a genius in physics, an adult in social relationships. But if you specify the time and the respect, either he is it or he isn't. And so on for a variety of examples. This is called the law of excluded middle, and the name was given it by Aristotle, because its essence is to say between A and non-A, the middle is out. There is no middle. The middle is excluded. Your choice is exclusively in the extremes. It is or it isn't, but no third middle of the road possibility exists. Now notice, this law does not say everything is either A or B. It does not say a man is either a genius or a dolt. No law could possibly say that, because it isn't true. It says a man is either a genius or he is not a genius. Or to put the thing even more broadly, it says an existent, a thing, is either a genius or it isn't. And then the category of non-genius includes all the men of average intelligence and the men who are dolts and this wristwatch, which is not a genius. So you have to understand that it does not say everybody is either rich or poor. It says a thing is either rich or it isn't. And that might include middle income, low income, no income, or the whole category of income is inapplicable. Now, the law of excluded middle is very close to the law of contradiction, but you can distinguish it. It plugs the gap of another type of assault on the law of identity. One way you could violate the law of identity and make something into nothing would be to say it is and it isn't. Another way would be to say it's neither of those two. It's neither A nor non-A, in which case, of course, there would be nothing for it to be, and it would end up as zero. So it was to plug this particular loophole that Aristotle defined the law of excluded middle. Combining the two, a thing has to be either A or non-A, and it can't be both, and therefore it must be something. Now these three, the law of identity, the law of contradiction, the law of excluded middle, are the classic three Aristotelian laws of logic. And as you see, there really is one, the law of identity. Now there's all sorts of more specific laws, and many we will look at in this course. For instance, if A leads to B and A is true, then B must be true. But in that case and in all the other cases, they reduce back simply to these basic laws. All the detailed logical laws and methods we will study are merely detailed applications of the same basic principle. There are various ways of letting you know whether you are or are not adhering to the law of identity. Well, what then does being logical consist of? At this stage, we can summarize in two generalized points. Negatively, it means never hold contradictions. That's obvious. Positively, it means always check every conclusion you accept against the facts by means of logic. Before coming to any conclusion, ask why. What are the facts? What are the premises which support it? Are they true, and does my conclusion follow from them? In other words, the second point means putting the process of logic, of non-contradictory identification, to work to ensure that your conclusion does correspond to the facts. Now, what is the name given to the process of putting logic to work? That is called proof. Here's a definition for you. Proof is the process of deriving a conclusion from antecedently known truths by reference to and on the basis of the laws of logic. The process of deriving a conclusion from antecedently known truths by reference to and on the basis of the laws of logic. Now, observe that your premises must be true if it's to qualify as a proof. If I point to you in the front row and say, premise one is you are an apple, and premise two is you are a peach, and premise three is you, pointing to a third person, are a banana, I can logically draw the conclusion that the front row is populated with a fruit salad. But that is not a proof. So if your premises in any given argument are not true, they in turn must be proved. What is the ultimate foundation? The direct evidence of the senses. The direct evidence of sense experience. And therefore, if you wanted a full, formal definition of proof, you would have to say something on this order. Proof is the process of deriving a conclusion step by step from the directly given evidence of the senses, each step being taken in accordance with and on the basis of the laws of logic. If you start with sensory evidence and step by step, your reasoning is guaranteed by the law of identity, at the end you can claim, I know, I have proved. What is the opposite of proof? That is putting something forth arbitrarily. The arbitrary, which is the opposite of proof, means that which is put forth without basis, without evidence or proof, by whim, by random, gratuitous, baseless, groundless caprice. If I, for instance, suddenly am demoniacally seized and I say I have a thought, gold in my ear is at this moment engaged in a contest with Moshe and Diane to see who can best throw darts across the room and spear gefilte fish. And you say to me, why do you believe it? And I say, I don't know. It just came to me. I just put it forth for what it's worth. The answer is, it's worth zero. Because it is completely arbitrary, a gratuitous assertion without basis. Now, the meaning of being logical, therefore, you want it in two negative statements, is shun contradictions and shun the arbitrary. In other words, apart from axioms, offer proof of every idea that you have. If you can do that, you are a logical person. Let us take our break here. All right, let us continue. Now, since our purpose this evening is introductory, to get clear the philosophical foundations of logic, it's worth spending a few minutes on two false philosophic doctrines that are particularly relevant to the issue of logic. Each of these doctrines represents a direct attack on logic, And each can be easily unmasked on the basis of what we've said so far. And the two doctrines I have in mind are mysticism and subjectivism. And let us look first at mysticism. The definition of mysticism is as follows. It is the view that a knowledge of reality is possible by means other than logic based on sense experience. The view that knowledge of reality is possible by means other than logic based on sense experience. In other words, it is the belief in some non-sensory, non-rational means of knowledge. What means? Well, the answers given by mystics are endless. Revelation from God, intuition, faith, hunch, a trance mediated by laughing gas through LSD, instinct. One existentialist recommends boredom. These are just a sample. Now, what is common to all of these mystical variants? In fact, there's only one thing common to them, which is what the mystic actually does appeal to, and that is emotion, his feeling. You can see this if you ask, how do you know, for instance, what is a true revelation as against a false pseudo-revelation? And the only ultimate answer to that question is, if you get the real goods, you just feel it. You feel that this is really the true one as against a pseudo one. What do you do if your hunch to take that variant contradicts somebody else's hunch? If you are a full mystic, you say, I just know that my hunch is better. I feel that my hunch is superior to his. Regardless of what any particular mystic says, mysticism therefore comes down to the view that feelings are valid tools of knowledge. Now notice that mysticism, as I have defined it, is not an issue of the content of your viewpoint, but of the means which you put forth to validate that content. It is possible, for instance, for a man to believe in God and not to be a mystic. He may believe, as Thomas Aquinas did, that you can give logical arguments based on data obtained from the senses and rigorously prove the existence of God. Now, that view, according to objectivism, is mistaken. It's wrong. But insofar as he's appealing only to sensory evidence and logic, as he thinks he is doing, he is not being mystical. On the other hand, you can be a mystical atheist. If you go into a trance from LSD and you emerge from it and you say the secret of the universe has been revealed to me in that trance and the secret is there is no God, that is mysticism, even though the content denies one particular form of it. The key to mysticism is the view that feelings are valid tools of knowledge. Now let's ask, why aren't they? What is wrong with mysticism? Well, on one obvious level, you could answer, feelings are the product, ultimately, of one's ideas, of one's thinking. The fact that you have a certain feeling means merely that at some point in the past, explicitly or implicitly, you had a certain thought or thoughts. Obviously, the fact that you have the feeling doesn't show that the feeling or the thought from which it comes is correct, that it's true to reality. If you were to establish that, you would need a method of validating the thought. In other words, you would need logic. Now, this is precisely what the mystic denies. The core of mysticism is the denial of the fact that man needs any standard or method to validate his conclusions. If you take any one of those variants I mentioned, revelation, trance, hunch, etc., it is not, if you are to be precise, it is not that this is a false method of acquiring knowledge. It is actually no method. The mystic's ultimate answer, if you ask him how he knows what he knows is, I just know it, which translates into, I just feel it. I had the blinding flash, and that's it. And in this connection, the famous mystical statement is very illuminating. To those who understand, no explanation is necessary. To those who do not understand, no explanation is possible. In either case, I don't explain. Mysticism consists in essence of saying, take the content of your consciousness, the content as it is at any given time, no matter how or by what means you actually acquired it, and consider that content true. Take the content of your consciousness as an unchallengeable given, which requires no check, no validating process, which is right simply because it exists in your mind. In other words, mysticism actually implies determinism. It implies an automatic view of consciousness. It implies the view that human consciousness is a determined, automatically correct mechanism, which therefore would need to undergo no special process of validation for its content. The case of the animals is relevant here. Whatever an animal feels is unchallengeable by the animal. It simply takes its content as there. It doesn't dream of questioning or checking it. It's simply taken as right without question. Well, now what a mystic does is treat his consciousness like an animal treats its. The difference is that the mystic operates on the conceptual level, where consciousness is not automatic, where volition enters, and where a validating standard is required. Consequently, the result of mysticism is to leave men cognitively helpless. Mysticism is a negative doctrine. It simply deprives man of any means of validating his intellectual content. It cuts the tie between human consciousness and existence, and leaves man without any guidance cognitively, without any means of acquiring knowledge. You can look at it this way. Mysticism is to epistemology what amorality is to ethics. Now, amorality is not a code of ethics. It is the denial of ethics. It deprives men of any standards or methods to determine how to act. And in practice, of course, an amoralist assumes and relies implicitly upon whatever random values he already happens to have absorbed and accepted, whether they are valid or not. Well, what an amoralist does in action, a mystic does in the realm of thought. From another perspective, you can say mysticism amounts to the reversion to barbarism. Prior to the Greeks, prior to Aristotle, prior to the time when logic was defined, people were by default effectively in the position of mystics, as apart from such logic as they used without being consciously aware of the issue. But in this primitive state, they were drowned in superstitions. They were helpless to know how to challenge their confusions, how to straighten out their thinking, how to conform it to reality, because no method had been defined. There was no standard to guide them. Now, prior to the Greeks, you could say, well, people couldn't help it. But after Aristotle, to reintroduce the idea of taking one's mental content as the infallible given, and to urge people to dispense with a validating standard is simply to tell men that they should, on principle, model their minds after primitive savages. Now, it's interesting to note here that occasionally the mystic himself feels his lack of epistemological standards and tries to find a solution. This normally happens when he is trying to engage in some common venture, some organized action with other mystics. And then you see the spectacle of a group of men without any epistemological standards trying to find some way to hold their movement together. The best examples come from the history of religion. Take simply as one example, Christianity. It was born in an enormously mystical age in which everybody was, or the leading thinkers, if you can call them that, were advocating faith. And in that cultural atmosphere, you would be surprised at the rate of revelations. They were coming in thick and fast. Everybody and his brother were having them. They had no standard by which to determine what is a true revelation and what is not. And the result is the religion was in grave danger of falling apart into a whole host of competing sects, each insistent that it had the true word of God. They felt desperately the need for some standard to say which revelations are really correct and which are not. And of course, the standard could not be logic. And so the device that they fell back upon was a meeting periodically of the appropriate church officials to put the imprimatur, the stamp of approval on certain doctrines, collect them all together into a sacred text, which we now know as the Bible, and say, thus far and no further. Whatever is in here is correct, and the age of revelations is now finished. And of course, I don't mean to discriminate against Christianity. All the rest developed the same way, and this is the reason for such a thing as a Torah, a Quran, etc. The sacred text is to a religion what logic is to a rational man. It's his standard for measuring intellectual content, for putting limits on what is and is not acceptable. And this is the reason why science does not require a sacred text, because it has a method, whereas religions do. Now, I assume it's unnecessary here to comment on sacred texts as an epistemological standard. If you have any doubts, just read one. All right, now let's say a few words on subjectivism. I said earlier that there were two tenets at the base of the need for logic. One is a certain view of human consciousness as volitional, as non-automatic. And the other is a certain view of reality, the primacy of existence, the metaphysical foundation of logic. Mysticism, as we've just seen, is the doctrine which results from attacking the epistemological basis of logic, from attacking the view of consciousness as volitional, as non-automatic, and therefore as requiring a standard. While subjectivism is the doctrine that attacks the metaphysical root of logic. Subjectivism is the view that reality depends on the content of human consciousness. It's the primacy of consciousness, but restricted to human consciousness. So you could think of it, for purposes of this course, as simply the view that reality depends on or is determined by the content of human consciousness. Now we can therefore distinguish, you see, between subjectivism and mysticism. Mysticism is essentially an epistemological doctrine. It's a theory of how to go about acquiring knowledge. And its answer is know-how. Just take whatever you've got. Subjectivism is a metaphysical doctrine, basically. It's a view of the nature of reality, which of course implies certain things for how to acquire knowledge, but its central thrust is that reality is dependent on the content of human consciousness. In that sense, it's a form of the primacy of consciousness. Now, I assume that you are familiar with the error of the primacy of consciousness, but what I want to do here is merely to show you briefly in what way subjectivism is fundamentally an anti-logic viewpoint, an assault on logic. Subjectivism represents a fundamental attack on the view of reality upon which logic is based. It's an attack on the metaphysical roots of logic, and therefore it is just as blatantly anti-logic as open, unabashed mysticism is. There are several points worth making here. First of all, in attacking the primacy of existence, subjectivism does away with the need or the possibility of any method of validating one's mental content. If you remember why the primacy of existence is the presupposition of logic, then any attack on the primacy of existence does away immediately with the need or possibility of any such method as logic. If you are a subjectivist and claim that facts are plastic, that they're anything you want them to be, that manipulations with inside your consciousness will create the corresponding facts, you have then wiped out the basis for any such phenomenon as logic. Now, you've all met subjectivists who claim to argue for their views, and then to demand that you refute them, that you disprove them, that you argue against them, etc. Now, what I want to point out is that any such claim by a subjectivist, whether he claims to put forth an argument for his view or demand a refutation from you, is incompatible with the very nature of subjectivism. As soon as a man says argument, refutation, proof, disproof, or any synonyms of those terms, he is using concepts that depend upon the phenomenon of logic. On a subjectivist view, there is no such thing as logic, nor therefore argument, proof, refutation, etc. Logic itself and anything that depends on it is a stolen concept to a subjectivist. His view of necessity is devoid of any argument or proof. It's arbitrary, unavoidably, as a matter of principle, and as such, of course, it's to be dismissed as any arbitrary utterance is to be. Now, I have assumed here that you're familiar with Ayn Rand's definition of the fallacy of the stolen concept. Just to refresh your recollection in a sentence, the stolen concept fallacy is the fallacy of using a concept while ignoring or denying one or more basic concepts on which it depends. Using a concept, relying on it, while ignoring or denying a more basic concept on which it depends. The subjectivist is a good example. He denies the concept of reality, that is to say, of independent reality, there is no other. He denies the concept of independent reality and proceeds to claim that he has proof of his point. Now, regardless of the nature of his alleged proof, this is a classic example of the stolen concept fallacy, because the concept of proof presupposes the concept of reality. If there were no independent reality, there could be no such thing as proof. Proof about what? Proof based on what? Proof by whom? The facts are, first, people have to grasp the fact of a firm objective reality. And then and only then, after a long chain of further discoveries, which took centuries, could people reach the concept of a certain method of conforming their thought to that reality, the method of proof. At this point, after this long intellectual development, the subjectivist enters the scene, blasts the foundations, throws out the concept of reality, and proceeds blithely to say, here is my proof. Even though on his premises that concept is now impossible and invalid. Now, that is the stolen concept. You see, he's stealing it. He has no cognitive, no epistemological right to that concept on his premises. It's a blatant example of the stolen concept fallacy. And now another point in connection with subjectivism. It represents an attack not only on the metaphysical basis of logic, on the reason of the need for logic, but directly on the laws of logic themselves. Each subjectivist, you see, ultimately, if you push him in a corner, will be forced to hold that his own consciousness creates reality and that somebody else's creates it differently. And the tip-off phrase in this connection, the almost infallible sign of a subjectivist, is that he will not say about an idea he accepts, this is true. He will say, it is true for me, for you, for him, for her, for it, for us, for them, for the Middle Ages, for the 19th century, for Americans, etc. But he will always say true for. His view, therefore, you see, is not A is A, no matter who believes what or feels what, etc. His view is A for you, but it might be non-A for me, and it might be A and non-A for him, and it might be neither A nor non-A for her. A isn't A, it's whatever anybody wants it to be for him. Now the way that subjectivists, insofar as they don't do it on the basis of a fundamentally corrupt philosophy, the way that they get away with this expression, true for me versus for you, etc., is by some crude fallacies, and one or two tricks in particular I want to simply call your attention to in passing. When I teach logic in school, I offer the class a guaranteed A in the course. We cover subjectivism in the first week or so. And I offer them a guaranteed A in the course if they can produce one sentence, which I will then write on the blackboard, and establish that that one sentence is true for some and not for others. That's all they have to do. So, of course, they rush out to find the sentence. And I feel safe in making that offer because I know it cannot be done. But I'll give you two of the type of examples that I get because it might be helpful to you in dealing with them. I think of these as the spinach and the bad cold examples. Usually, it begins with the student saying, some men like spinach. So I then put on the board and they say, well, there, that's true for some and not for others. Now, do you see what the fallacy of that is? That is an example, the statement, some men like spinach, of the fact that something can be true of some men and not of others. Nothing in the laws of logic that prohibit that. Obviously, a certain characteristic may be possessed by some members of a class and not by others. This is not an example of a statement which is true for some and not for others. The statement, some men like spinach, is true for all the men who like spinach, and it is just as true for all the men who do not like spinach. It is absolutely true for the non-spinach likers that some men like spinach. Now, we don't have to go through all the other vegetables. I think the point is clear. The other type of example I frequently get is a statement, I have a bad cold. And then the person will say, well, isn't that a statement? For instance, suppose he has a cold and I don't. Or Brown has a cold and Smith doesn't. He'll say, well, then, that statement is true for Brown and not for Smith. Now, there's the actual same statement, true for one and not for another. Now, do you see the fallacy in that one? And the statement, I have a cold, derives its force from the pronoun I, which simply is a substitute for whoever is uttering it. When Brown says, I have a cold, the statement means Brown has a cold. And that statement is true for everybody. Brown and all the non-Browns in the world, whether they do or don't have colds, if he has a cold, it's true for everybody that he has one. Similarly, when Smith utters the words, I have a cold, in the connection with Smith uttering it, the meaning of that statement, if you properly specify it, is Smith has a cold. And that statement is true for everybody, Smith or non-Smith, cold or non-cold. Now, the illusion that you have here, a statement which is true for some and not for others, derives from the fact that the statement is improperly or incompletely specified. You simply take a form of words in this case, not realizing that the full meaning has not been stated, and therefore you switch the meaning of the statement from one case to the other and think you have a statement which is true for some and not for others. If, however, you clearly specify the actual meaning of a statement, it is impossible to come up with any statement which is true for some and not for others, for the simple reason that A is A. If something is so, it is so, and it does not vary from person to person. Therefore, the first thing you should do in order to assimilate the law of identity, if you haven't already, is do not say true for. If it's true, it is true. It corresponds to the facts, or it does not. It can't do so for some and not for others. That's the tip-off of a subjectivist. All right, let us sum up this point on mysticism and subjectivism. Mysticism deprives man of any method of validating his thought. Subjectivism deprives him of any firm object about which to think. Mysticism cuts the tie between consciousness and existence, which means it really denies that man is conscious, because if you're not conscious of existence, there's nothing else to be conscious of. Subjectivism denies that existence exists, that there is a firm, definite reality. The mystic says you don't have to identify non-contradictorily. Any old way is okay. The subjectivist says, what do you mean identify? There's nothing to identify. You create whatever you want by manipulating your mental content. Now, these two doctrines are equally opposed to logic. The precondition of being logical is complete repudiation of both. Logic implies a commitment to give proof, which means the complete abandonment of mysticism. And it implies a commitment to objectivity, which in this context we can define as simply the recognition of the primacy of existence. That is to say that facts are what they are, independent of what goes on in anybody's mind, and therefore if you want to know facts, you have to focus your mind outward on the facts, not inward on whatever twists and turns thrill through your consciousness. In this connection, the best symbol of objectivity was the old Dragnet program. Remember, they used to interview witnesses, and Jack Webb would say, just give us the facts, man. That is the pure pro-logic attitude. Now we have one last topic to discuss this evening in our theoretical introduction to logic. There is a concerted attack on the laws of logic launched by both mystics and subjectivists via a different point than any we've touched on so far. They claim, well, they say, the whole structure of logic then rests on the laws of logic, ultimately on the law of identity. But you can't prove the law of identity, and therefore, aren't you left flat at the outset? Now let's deal with this briefly. Of course, it is true. You cannot prove the laws of logic. That should be obvious. The laws of logic are the principles of proof. You couldn't get a proof off the ground until you had the laws of logic. Therefore, it would be a theoretical impossibility to offer a proof of the principles of proof. Obviously, again, to request a proof of the laws of logic is immediately to commit what fallacy? Fallacy of the stolen concept. A person who says, I don't accept the laws of logic, but I accept proof. Now give me a proof of logic. Where did he get such a concept as proof? And what makes it possible if he does not accept the laws of logic? As soon as you say proof, you have already carried in its train everything that proof depends on, including the principles of proof. So the very request for a proof of the laws of logic is a stolen concept. Well, but that still leaves us with the question, what then is the status of the law of identity if it is outside entirely the province of demonstration, argumentation, or proof? And Aristotle's answer to this question was, the law of identity, or he discussed it in connection with the law of contradiction, but it's the same point. The law of identity is self-evident. Self-evident. He said, it requires no outside evidence. Any case of directly perceiving reality is a case where you see, he said, self-evidently, an instance of the law of identity. In the act of any sense perception of reality, whatever you see, even if you have no idea what it is, you know immediately, directly, implicitly, whatever it is something. It is what it is. The mystics who denounce the self-evident say it's arbitrary. The subjectivists denounce it on the grounds that it's not objective. But in any event, let us briefly tell you what was Aristotle's answer to this charge in regard to the laws of logic. And his answer was as follows. The laws of logic, he said, are at the base of all human activities. They are at the base of reasoning, of the sheer act of speech, of uttering a single sentence, of any voluntary action a person takes. Let's first review that much. Why? Why are they at the base of reasoning? We've already seen that. Reasoning is simply the use of the laws of logic to derive conclusions from premises. So anytime anybody reasons or argues at all, he is immediately using the laws of logic. Why are they at the base of speaking? Well, there are a great many points you could make, but the obvious point is, if things aren't what they are, there is nothing to refer to. If nothing has any identity, words have no meaning, and you can't open your mouth to utter a single sentence. Aristotle makes a somewhat different point in this connection. The way he puts it, and I quote now from Book M of the Metaphysics, his famous discussion of the laws of logic, "Our discussion with such a man he means a person who denies the laws of logic, is evidently about nothing at all, for he says nothing. For he says neither yes nor no, but yes and no." See, he advocates contradictions, so he's like the 75 and not 75. He says, yes, he believes it, and no, he doesn't. And Aristotle goes on and says, and again, he denies both of these and says neither yes nor no, for otherwise there would already be something definite. You see, the advocate of the law, the opponent of the law of contradiction won't commit himself to any A being A, to anything being definite. So he says yes, no, but not yes and not no. So Aristotle summarizes like this. One who is in this condition will not be able either to speak or to say anything intelligible. For he says at the same time both yes and no. I'll think it and I won't think it, you see. And Aristotle adds, therefore, quote, and if he makes no judgment but thinks and does not think indifferently, what difference will there be between him and a vegetable? Unquote. So the law of contradiction is the acceptance of it, of laws of logic, of law of identity, is a precondition of all reasoning, a precondition of speech, and, as Aristotle points out, a precondition of any deliberately initiated action. And he has a very clear passage on this. Quote, for why does a man walk to Megara and not stay at home when he thinks he ought to be walking there? Why does he not walk early some morning into a well or over a precipice, if one happens to be in his way? Why do we observe him guarding against this? Evidently because he does not think that falling in is alike good and not good. Evidently then he judges one thing to be better and another worse. And if this is so, he must also judge one thing to be a man and another to be not a man. One thing to be sweet and another to be not sweet. For he does not aim at and judge all things alike. When, thinking it desirable to drink water or to see a man, he proceeds to aim at these things. And yet he ought, if the same thing were alike a man and not a man. But as was said, there is no one who does not obviously avoid some things and not others. Therefore, as it seems, all men make unqualified judgments. Unquote. And you see, his argument is that's a precondition of any action that you take. Now, of course, he had in Greece the same mentality we have today, who would come back and say, well, this is simply a convenient assumption that we make, or practical necessity, but it doesn't represent true knowledge. The Greek way of putting that would be to say, this is simply opinion, not knowledge. So Aristotle covers that in the following aside. Quote, and if this is not knowledge but opinion, then you should be all the more anxious about the truth, as a sick man should be more anxious about his health than one who is healthy. For he who has opinions is, in comparison with the man who knows, not in a healthy state as far as the truth is concerned. Unquote. Aristotle's point is that the laws of logic are at the base of all human activities. of reasoning, of speaking, of acting. Therefore, he says, the laws of logic are inescapable. And this leads to the very crucial conclusion that they must be used even to be denied, must be relied upon and accepted even by the opponents of the laws of logic. In the very act of trying to deny them, he counts upon them. Now, Aristotle discusses this point at length. I will make up a brief paraphrase so as not to read a long text from him, but which will contain the essence of this point. Imagine a conversation between a skeptic, i.e. someone in this connection who denies the laws of logic, and Aristotle. And it would take place approximately on the following pattern. The skeptic comes in and says, I deny the laws of logic. And Aristotle says, I'm happy to hear that you are a champion of logic. The skeptic says, you misunderstood me. I oppose the laws of logic. Completely opposed to the law of identity. Aristotle says, it does my heart good to hear such a fervent advocate of logic. The skeptic says, look, you understand, I believe everything is contradictory. I completely deny the laws of logic in every respect. Everything is A and non-A. Aristotle says, marvelous. Now we have two people, you and me, who can go out and champion logic. The skeptic says, look, it's impossible to talk to you. If I say the laws of logic are false, then if they're false, they're false. If I utter certain words, I uttered those words and not their opposite, and those words mean what they mean and nothing else. After all, things are what they are. A is A. Now that is known as the technique invented by Aristotle of reaffirmation through denial. Reaffirmation through denial. In other words, in the very act of denying the laws of logic, you are constrained to reaffirm them. They come back to get you. You cannot even deny them without accepting them, which simply illustrates the fact that all knowledge, speech, reasoning, thinking presupposes the laws of logic, so that even the opponents of those laws must use them to utter their position. In this sense, the laws of logic are truly inescapable. As the self-evident base of all cognition, they are presupposed in any utterance, including any attack on them. Now, this is a very brilliant technique devised by Aristotle, but I'd like you to note before we leave it that it is not a proof of the laws of logic. For the reasons we've already mentioned, there is no such thing as a proof of the laws of logic. Therefore, even this brilliant technique of reaffirmation through denial leaves a loophole to the irrationalist if he wants to take advantage of it. Because he can say, and some of the more sophisticated ones do, well, you yourself were presupposing the law of identity by speaking, and I don't accept it. And therefore the whole reaffirmation through denial argument itself presupposes the acceptance of the law of identity, and I don't. Now go ahead and do something to me. And the only answer is you cannot speak to such a person. If he is an avowed, explicit advocate of absurdity, like Tertullian, whom we cited, there is nothing you can do and nothing you should do. The law of identity is truly self-evident. The value of the reaffirmation through denial technique is only for a certain type, namely the type that thinks he can be rational and still not accept the laws of logic. Now that type, you can show that he is bizarrely contradicting himself if he rejects logic, that he has to accept it even to reject it. But if he's openly pro-erasmus and said, well, so what? That's just another contradiction. Do something. You cannot say anything. You must leave such a person to his own devices. And in fact, you merely sanction him if you attempt to argue further with him. Once a person is an open advocate of absurdity, openly denounces and rejects the principles of argument, it is senseless to argue. All right, that concludes the theoretical points I wanted to make this evening. You know now in general terms what logic is, why it's necessary, and what's wrong with certain of the major attacks on it and on its necessity. Now let's say a few concluding words about what this course on logic consists of. Now a course on logic is really a series of pointers accumulated over the centuries, very heavily derived from Aristotle himself, a series of pointers as to how to perform accurately the process of non-contradictory identification. So it's a course on methodology, not on content. It's not on physics or psychology or chemistry or astronomy. Its object of study is the process of logical validation itself, no matter to what content or subject matter that process is applied. Now, the major topics in any such course are the two fundamental types of reasoning, the two fundamental types of inference, deduction and induction. Each of these types can be performed validly or invalidly. To give you just an example without going into the theory at this point, if I say all men are mortal, all pigs are mortal, therefore all men are pigs, that is deductive reasoning, but very bad deductive reasoning. If I say this Chinaman is a laundryman, and this one is, and this one is, and after seeing four of them, I say, therefore, everyone Chinese runs a laundry, that is induction, but it is very bad induction. And so the question, of course, on logic does is ask, when is deduction or induction valid, and when is it not? And it attempts to formulate an abstract statement of the proper laws governing each. And from this point of view, logic as a branch of study is often defined as the science of valid inference, the science of valid inference. Now, students frequently ask, well, is logic an art or a science? And the answer is it is both and can be defined either way, and it depends on which perspective you're looking at. When you think of logic as a method which men actually employ, they actually put into practice in governing their thought, from that aspect, logic is an art, which consists of using a certain method. But when you consider the systematic study of this method and the formal elaboration of its principles, from that aspect, logic is a science, the science describing the principles of that method. Now, much more has been learned so far in the history of thought about deduction than about induction, about which comparatively little is still known. And usually, therefore, a course in logic is heavily on the side of deduction. In addition to these two major subjects, deduction and induction, there are usually two other topics included in logic courses. One is what is called the common or informal fallacies. They're called informal fallacies because they are applicable no matter what the form of the reasoning, whether deductive or inductive. You can commit them no matter what type of reasoning. And there is about 20 of them, 20 odd, very widespread, and it's traditional always to begin courses on logic with a survey of these common fallacies. And then the other topic that's virtually always included is definitions, the rules of proper definition. This gets included as an adjunct to the study of inference, because all reasoning presupposes clearly defined concepts. Now, these are the four areas that will make up this course. We'll spend 2 weeks, starting next week, with the common fallacies. I have reduced the deduction section down to 3 lectures, which will follow the common fallacies. We'll then spend 2 weeks on definition, and finally, induction, and that will include a discussion of the principles of analogy, will be the last 2 weeks. Now, I think you can see the relationship between a course on epistemology and one on logic. Epistemology is the much wider subject. It's concerned with the means of human knowledge in general, and therefore it deals with all of the host of philosophic issues that are involved in the acquisition of knowledge. For instance, the validity of the senses, the theory of concept formation, the status of axioms, the nature of certainty, etc. Now, logic does not deal with these broad philosophic subjects. You can think of it as one area within the broader subject of epistemology, specifically the study of the process of inference. And the central question is, does such and such a conclusion follow from these premises or not? In a course on logic, then, virtually none of the major epistemological questions are explicitly raised. A logic course is a narrower, more technical study of one aspect of the process of acquiring knowledge, the process of inference. Now, generally speaking, with appropriate exceptions, the points studied in a logic course are not controversial. In other words, no matter what a philosopher's epistemology, I'm speaking here in a very broad way and with many exceptions, but in a broad way. The general rules of deduction, for instance, or the common fallacies are recognized and accepted by most schools of philosophy. Now, of course, sometimes a philosopher's overall epistemology will affect his interpretation of questions of logic. So if you hear a pragmatist or a positivist or some species of subjectivist lecture on definitions, you will get a radically different treatment from what you'll get in this course. But on the whole, there is a body of logical material on which there is fairly widespread agreement among philosophers, and that is what a course on introductory logic concentrates on. So I want to make clear to you now that this course, the one we're talking about, this course, is not a course on objectivism and not a course on objectivist epistemology. Now, occasionally I will have to refer to certain principles of objectivism in order to explain various points. But on the whole, we will not be discussing objectivist ideas. You've had this evening just about as much objectivism as you're going to get in this course. Now, needless to say, objectivism agrees with what I'll be presenting, but so do most other philosophers today. After tonight, the content, with certain exceptions, will not be distinctive to objectivism. I want to make this point clear here, because I hope that no one has enrolled on the premise that this is a course on objectivism, which it is not. I've tried to make that clear in the brochure by saying that I would cover the standard topics taught in introductory college courses in Aristotelian logic. And I want to give you one more warning in advance so as not to oversell you. In a course on logic, the material is uneven. Some of it I regard as valuable and is actually very helpful in promoting clear logical thinking. Some of it, however, I regard as almost too obvious to require discussion. There is a regrettable tendency among logicians, and you could even point to certain elements in Aristotle, but he was virtually guiltless in this respect, but among other logicians, there is a regrettable tendency to take obvious common sense points and dress them up in mathematical symbols or fancy technical names for no reason other than to appear scientific. Now, from this point of view, a disillusioned student of logic once defined it as the subject in which horse sense is made asinine. Now, I am going to do everything I can to play down that element in this course and focus on the material which is not in that category. But there is a little. And I would like you to know that. Now, it's normal in introductory logic courses to divide the course about 50-50. 50% presentation of theory, 50% concrete exercises, which illustrate the theory and give the class the opportunity to get some practice in spotting actual fallacies in particular cases. And I am going to follow this standard procedure. Now, I have prepared myself a little booklet in which I have made up several hundred examples of the various errors, the fallacies, and the types of arguments that we will be discussing. Next week, each enrolled student will receive a copy of this booklet. Needless to say, there will be no charge. It's part of the course. After each lecture, having covered certain theoretical topics, I will assign the relevant sections of this book for homework and then take up the answers in the subsequent session. And I hope that those enrolled will find this combination
of theory and practice illuminating. So let me add here that if you're going to get the full benefit out of the course, please try and remember this. It will be necessary for you to bring this booklet to class each week. And also, let me say, to bring a notebook and a pen or pencil. We will not have a blackboard during this course, and there are several things you will have to be able to see before you in written form, in which I will dictate. Not too many, but some. And if you don't have a notebook, you will be unable to do the exercises or even to retain the theory. All right, next week we will begin with our first subject, the common fallacies. Until then, thank you. Now, I have a vast array of written questions here, so let me take some of these and then alternate with oral ones. One question I got several times is, could I suggest reading matter aside from Aristotle? Yes, there are all kinds of introductory texts on logic, which vary. Undoubtedly, the best one from a theoretical point of view is by a man called Joseph. H.W.B. are his three initials, Joseph. It's called Introduction to Logic, or Logic and Introduction. All these books have the exact same title, Introduction to Logic. And it is a thorough, systematic presentation of the Aristotelian theory of logic. It is not by any means at every point in agreement when it extends itself into broader theory with objectivism, but it is the best single book on the Aristotelian theory of logic. A more practically oriented book, which has exercises and so on, is unfortunately out of print, but it's the best one I have found. So if you can get it, it is of value in taking the topics that we will be covering, explaining them very simply, although it's not nearly as theoretical or profound as Joseph, and that is by Lionel Ruby, R-U-B-Y. The last that was imprinted was in its second edition, and it's also called Logic and Introduction, or Introduction to Logic, something like that. There are a vast number of other books. Virtually anyone is all right, so long as you read them with an appropriately critical eye, particularly when you get to anything which is philosophical as against narrowly the rules of deduction and so on. The best way to check a book is by reference to the section on definition. If you get to read the section on definition and they begin with some such statement as definitions are an expression of the way people arbitrarily use words, and there is only two types of definition. On the one hand, those which report how men collectively use a word arbitrarily. On the other hand, those which arbitrarily declare that you yourself are going to use a word a certain way. Then you know right off what type of mentality you're dealing with, and that will show up throughout. One of the virtues of Ruby's book was he didn't take that view. But between Ruby and Joseph, you will have a basis. Now, here's a question. Many universities do not have a traditional course as you described it. They begin by defining logic as a study of how to manipulate sentences to preserve truth value. Such courses are anti-conceptual and require only mechanical symbol manipulations as proof. What should we do if required to take such a course? Well, if you're required to take such a course, you have to take it. The best thing I can suggest is that you remind yourself and say over and over again, what is wrong with such a course? Learn it the way you learn a foreign language, only one that you do not intend to speak. Simply that you intend to pass an exam in and forget it as thoroughly as you can after. It may be appropriate here to say that objectivism is entirely 100% opposed to what is today called symbolic logic, which derives from a whole host of corrupt, rotten philosophical influences, of whom one of the leading ones is Bertrand Russell. We have got two essential objections to the whole field known as symbolic logic. It is useless. And it is based on a completely false philosophy. Other than that, it's okay. It is useless because there is a limited practical value in learning to symbolize argumentation. If a certain type of argument, a certain mode of argument, appears constantly and recurrently in people's actual thinking about real problems, then there is a certain limited value in symbolizing it, as Aristotle did with his syllogisms, and equipping people to grasp the form and the rules. But if you deliberately invent fantastic complexities that could not occur to a person in the normal course of trying to acquire knowledge, and it takes a special act, like a mentality that creates fantastic mazes as an end in itself, in order even to be thought of, and then page after page of symbolism in order to be symbolized, the only effect of that is to dissociate the student's mind from any such thing as thinking or facts or reality, and to convert what is allegedly logic into simply manipulation of letters according to rules for no purpose whatever. But beyond that, of course, all the advocates of symbolic logic claim as their basis not that this will give real practical guidance to people, which is the only purpose of such symbolism and logic, but that they are simply expressing their imagination and creativity, and that after all, any system of logic is as good as any other system, since logic is all arbitrary, and it depends upon which arbitrary postulates you begin with. And then they have the so-called multivalued system, which say, why should we accept the law of excluded middle and say there's only two choices, a proposition is true or false? Why not have the multivalued logic, in which case this can be true or false or doubtful? And then they work out a whole system of logic according to which there's three choices, or 100-valued logic. There is no true or false, there's 1% probable and 2% probable, etc. Now that is all philosophically simply corrupt. It is a detachment of logic from reality at the outset, and therefore makes the whole thing entirely useless. So those courses are completely wrong. It's a complete mistake for them to call it logic. They should call it some kind of linguistic manipulation. Well, they tell you that in class, but in the catalog they call it logic, and it should not be confused with logic. If you're caught in such a course, all you can do is memorize what you're told and then forget it as fast as you can. Here's a question. Why is comparatively little known about inductive reasoning, and what kinds of observations will be required to achieve such knowledge? That is a little premature at this point, since we haven't come to induction at the end, so I'll answer very briefly. And because a proper theory of inductive reasoning depends upon a valid theory of concept formation. Without a valid theory of concepts, you cannot formulate a valid theory of induction, whereas you can formulate a valid theory of deduction. Because the theory of concepts is in such a horrendous state philosophically, that has sabotaged the theory of induction. But as to where the theory of induction is, how it stands at its best, you will hear that at the end of this course. One more, then I'll take some from the floor. Is there any serious attempt or possibility to defend mysticism without subjectivism, or the other way around? I.e., is the connection always one of psychoepistemology? I'm not clear what you mean by is the connection one of psychoepistemology. There are many subjectivists who claim that they repudiate mysticism. Mystics, in my experience, are not so eager to dissociate themselves from subjectivism, although some of them claim they have achieved the objective absolute truth in their revelation and therefore to be opposed to subjectivism. So to a certain extent, there are people who claim to be one rather than the other. In actual philosophic fact, of course, you can easily prove that either of these doctrines logically implies the other, and that if you were to be consistent, you should be both. But in the following way, a mystic says, emotions are your means of knowledge, for short. Well, on what premise would this be valid? Only if emotions actually control the facts of reality. If they did, then you could validly consult your emotions as the key to knowledge, because the emotions would coerce the fact into agreement. In that sense, mysticism presupposes and implies subjectivism. I mean, the same is true in the other direction. A subjectivist says you can rely on your emotions in order to acquire knowledge because your emotions control the facts. Well, in that process of relying on your emotions, that is simply mysticism, which is officially the theory that you can rely on your emotions. So the difference is really that the mystic frequently does not say that he is relying on his emotions, but on supernatural means, chemical means like LSD, etc. Whereas the out-and-out subjectivist will usually say he is going by his feelings. But either of these doctrines, in fact, implies the other. All right, do you want some live? Can I be... Yes, sir.
Following that mark,
Oh, didn't you write that question?
Right,
oh, okay. Let me repeat it then. Recalling that Marx was a materialist, which he claimed was based on sense perception, and that he claimed dialectic materialism was derived from observation of reality, in what sense would I claim that Marx represents a non-ontological approach to logic? I don't claim any such thing. To be an ontologist in logic is simply a necessary condition of having a correct theory of logic. It is not sufficient. The Marxists do not detach logic from reality. They do not say the logic is a matter of our linguistic conventions and we can make it whatever we want. They say, no, you have to be faithful to reality. So in that sense, yes, the Marxists are ontologists. There's only one little gimmick. They say that the essence of reality is that it is contradictory, and consequently that to be logical is to think, quote, dialectically. That is to think something and then to think its antithesis and then to combine both in a synthesis in which the two are so-called aufgehoben, and you have an A and a non-A which you're supposed to hold while you project the contradictory of that, and then you combine it in a higher synthesis and so on until you reach the jackpot, which is Hegel or Lenin, depending upon your view. Now that is not to be objected to on the grounds that it claims that logic has nothing to do with reality, but on the grounds that its view of reality is bizarre and blatantly contradictory and false, and therefore its logic is obviously wrong. All right, I'll take another. I don't want to argue about my answers, please. Is there any important reason why logic is defined in terms of identification and not in terms of thinking? Just the point I tried to make in the lecture, namely that thinking, according to objectivism, is the process of identification. So you simply make it a little more specific by saying, well, what does thinking consist of? And if you think about thinking, you'll see that all you can do when you think is essentially ask, what is something? If you ask why is something happening, you're asking what is the cause? What is the identity of the cause? If you ask where did it happen, you are asking what is the place? What is the identity of the place? If you ask when, what is the identity of the time? If you ask how, what is the identity of the means, etc. So there's really only one question you can ask in the process of thinking, and that is the question, what is it? In other words, the process of grasping identity is what thinking consists of, and that's why objectivism defines thinking or specifies it by saying thinking is a process of identification. Other, yes, sir.
Your definition of Marx, Marx is the art of non-contradictory thinking. I wanted to ask why you use the art.
I said logic is the art of non-contradictory identification. You want to know why I use the word art? Well, again, I tried to say in class, you can, in the lecture, you can take as your genus of logic either method, art, or science, depending upon the context that you have, that you're using. Fundamentally, logic is a method. It is a way of guiding your thinking. But now, there's two different ways of looking at that. You can either look at it from the point of view of the actual use of this method, the putting of it to work. in order to achieve a certain practical result, in which case you'll say it's an art, which is simply the implementation of a method to achieve a certain practical result. Or you can discuss the systematic scientific organization of the principles of that method, in which case you will say logic is the science of valid inference. So there's no contradiction between those. It depends on the context in which you use them. Here is one, a written one. Please comment on the relationship between a volitional consciousness and one that is fallible. Does one presuppose the other? I would say yes. A volitional consciousness is one that has a choice. It does not operate automatically. As such, there is nothing in such a consciousness to guarantee that its volitional element will be performed in accordance with the facts of reality. Having choice, it has the choice to adhere to the facts of reality or not. I would say, therefore, by my understanding, any volitional consciousness would have to be fallible. And I think the reverse would have to be true. If a consciousness is fallible and capable of error, then the only way that it could know anything would be if it had volition. That, indeed, is the basic objectivist argument in favor of volition. Precisely because man's consciousness is fallible, if he had no control over its use, if he had a consciousness that was capable of error, but was out of his control and went in deterministic form in whichever way it went, then he would never be able to rely on any conclusion because he would never know when he was determined by forces outside of his control to make an error. And therefore, a fallible consciousness, I would say, in order to be able to acquire any knowledge, would have to be a volitional consciousness. And, of course, a consciousness which could not acquire any knowledge would be unconscious. So I think those two certainly do imply each other. And, of course, the fundamental one is that consciousness is volitional. Does the law of the excluded middle, which allows only the extremes, relate to or contradict Aristotle's ethics of the mean? In other words, the theory of the golden mean. Well, it doesn't contradict literally. When Aristotle said, for instance, that all human attributes can be arranged in columns of three, an extreme in one direction, for instance, humility, where you have too low an opinion of yourself, and an extreme in the other direction, for instance, megalomania, where you have too high an opinion of yourself, and then in the middle, self-respect, which is supposedly the mean, in which you have just the right view of yourself, not too high and not too low, that is, for reasons which I won't go into here, a mistaken approach to ethics. In fact, it's an example of a certain common fallacy that we're going to discuss in the next couple of weeks, but it is not as such an explicit a violation of the law of excluded middle. It's not as though Aristotle says, either you are humble or you are not humble or there's a third possibility. He says either you're humble or you're not humble. And then within not humble, he allows two different values and organizes the whole thing in this Trinitarian threefold scheme. Now, I think there's many objections to Aristotle's ethics, but he does certainly not intend it to be taken as an objection, as a violation of the law of excluded middle, and nor do I see that it is. It's a violation of many things, but not of the law of excluded middle. Why are so many colleges today offering courses in mysticism and such as astrology? Well, why is the world today as it is? The central, paramount fact of the world today, philosophically, intellectually, is the sweep of irrationalism. Now, there's only so long that you can expect irrationalism to cover itself in the guise of being rational before it comes out blatantly as irrationalism. Now, some decades ago, they preached doctrines which were, in fact, just as irrational, but there were still the vestiges of the Age of Enlightenment, the age of reason, the age of science, and the dominant intellectual majority felt, you know, that they something abashing or something would make them ashamed to come out and say, I believe in courses in witchcraft, stigmata, Indian rope climbing, and so on. But that was the philosophic basis of such an attempt to keep a veneer of rationality, presupposed that there was at some point an authentic pro-reason view, and people, even though that view had been badly eroded in the 19th century, people still preserved the manners of advocating reason, even though if you took college courses in the 20s, you would be awash with irrationalism, but it wouldn't be naked and unashamed. It would be garbed and partially abashed. But at a certain point, that philosophic basis has gone from the intellectual world. They do not feel constrained anymore to pretend that they are advocates of reason, in which case you have the triumphant flourishing of Indian mysticism and Orientalism and courses in astrology and minor in warlocks, etc. Now, that is simply a sign of the complete bankruptcy, philosophically, of the culture and its dominance by irrationalism. And in that sense, it's more open and straightforward, you know what you're dealing with, than the advocates of symbolic logic courses who are just as irrational and dress it up under the pretense that they're offering courses in logic. Wasn't the Roman Catholic religion based on logic many, many years ago? I don't want to take on a particular religion in this connection. I'd be quite willing to, but I don't see any reason to restrict my remarks to any one particular one. So I'll simply make the flat statement, no religion could be based on logic because it would not then be a religion. A point that is certainly not original with me, but is insisted upon by most theologians today. Perfectly validly. If a religion is anything, it involves metaphysically supernaturalism, epistemologically faith, and some appropriate self-sacrificial code of ethics to go with it. But the essence is another world and a non-rational means of knowledge. If you took that away and said, I believe only in this world of nature as known by human sense perception on the basis of Aristotelian logic, there is nothing in that that leaves any room for religion, for God, for worship, for prayer, for sacrament, for ritual. It wipes out the entire thing. Therefore, a religion based on logic is a self-contradiction. What is true, however, is simply this much. Certain Catholic theologians, of whom the most famous and preeminent is Thomas Aquinas, believed that he could give a logical proof of certain tenets of Catholicism. And he made it the most valiant effort in history ever made to do so. He believed you could, for instance, prove the existence of God. Now, as an objectivist, I do not think that his proofs are valid, and indeed some of them in different connections we'll be seeing as examples of various fallacies in this course. But nevertheless, he did make an attempt, and to that extent, there is nothing in Protestantism or Judaism to compare to Aquinas' attempt to base religion on reason. I take that back because Moses Maimonides was an influence on Aquinas, and he was an attempt to do the same thing in Judaism. But the fact is that although this was an attempt, it was not a successful attempt. And in this respect, you cannot say it was not Catholicism based on logic. That one I don't think is directly relevant. Do I have another oral one? Yes.
Could you define induction and deduction?
Could I define induction and deduction? Yes, but not now, since we're going to be having whole lectures devoted to them. I will when we get there. But that reminds me of a written question. Would I repeat the definition of proof that I gave, the last one the questioner asks, and the way I defined it, this is a pretty large mouthful, but this is the essence of it. The process of deriving a conclusion step by step from the directly given evidence of the senses, each step being taken in accordance with and on the basis of the laws of logic. I'll say it once more. The process of deriving a conclusion step by step from the directly given evidence of the senses, each step being taken in accordance with and on the basis of the laws of logic. So the elements are there in the full sense of a proof, you start with sensory evidence, and each step from sensory evidence has to be based on the law of identity. In that, if you have that combination, you have a proof. This one I answer. What was the source of the quote by the follower of Bergson? Karen Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, a book called The Misuse of Mind, which is concerned to elaborate and defend Bergson's philosophy. I've said what I want to say about symbolic logic, so I will not comment further on set theory, etc. Do you have others? Yes.
Can you explain why even if it's called logic?
Why is the implementation of logic considered an art rather than a skill? Well, how do you distinguish an art from a skill? A skill is proficiency at some art, isn't it? At some technique, at some way of doing something. So, in that sense, whenever you apply an art, whenever you perform one, you either do it skillfully or not. But to say that you do it skillfully is already an estimate of how well you're doing it. And we want to define what is the actual phenomenon we're talking about, not how well have you done it. Now, how does the law of excluded middle apply to borderline cases? That is, existence which are neither clearly A nor non-A. Well, it depends what you mean by neither clearly A nor non-A. Now, we have red on the color spectrum, and we have orange, right? And in between is the borderline area, which is neither clearly red nor clearly orange. Now, leaving aside all the other questions about that, you want to know where does the law of excluded middle come in? And all the law of excluded middle says is this. Give me any definition of red. Draw the line anywhere on that spectrum. And it remains true that either a given shade is or is not red. Suppose we construe red in the narrowest terms as only those shades which are blatantly red and which don't give a hint of orangeness. If that's what we define as red, then the law of excluded middle says either a given shade is red or it isn't. By that definition, everything from the beginning of the border on through the blatantly orange is non-red. And of course, all the purple and green and the rest of it is non-red. Suppose you say, well, we have a more relaxed definition of red. We'll include the blatant red and halfway through the mixture. And then we'll stop there. Okay, if that's the definition of red, the law of excluded middle says either a thing is in that category, in which case it's red, or it isn't. In other words, the borderline case is completely doesn't touch the law of excluded middle. All the borderline case does is raise the question of definition. Where should you draw the line in a borderline case? Where should you start calling it red and stop calling it orange and so on? But that is a question of definition to which the law of excluded middle is invulnerable. I'm trying to get the ones that I think are of broader interest. No, I'm still opposed to symbolic logic, and I don't want to go into that. Would you please review Aristotle's argument against conclusions viewed as opinions? You made some analogy about health being more important to a non-healthy man. Oh, that was Aristotle's analogy, not mine. The Greeks distinguished, Plato and Aristotle both, between opinion and knowledge, what we would today call assumption, probability, guess, estimate, hypothesis versus knowledge. And of course, the skeptics of the time were prone to say there is no knowledge, there's only opinion. Or their modern counterparts would say there is no knowledge, there's only pragmatic assumption, unverifiable hypothesis, unprovable postulate, etc. Now, so when Aristotle argued against opinion in the quote I mentioned, he did not say there is no such thing as opinion. There is no such thing as hypothesis. Obviously, he knew that there were some things that we did not know, and some things that people put forth as knowledge which were not knowledge.
What he was saying, it was directed against the people who claim that that's all there is opinion. And there is no such thing as knowledge. All there is arbitrary hypotheses, postulates, guesses, etc. And his point, and what I gave, the extract I gave, was not a serious full argument against skepticism. He has a whole arsenal of arguments against skepticism. His point was simply, in effect, a crack. He said, if you hear what I said and said, oh yeah, it's just opinion, we don't have any knowledge, you should be all the more concerned about acquiring authentic knowledge, because I've shown you that you require that knowledge to live. And then he simply drew the parallel that a person who has only opinions, arbitrary postulates, assumptions, etc., in relation to a person who knows, is like a person who is sick in relation to a person who is healthy. And if you're sick, you should be more eager than ever to acquire health, because you see all the things that it makes possible. Similarly, he's saying to the skeptics, if all you have is opinion, you should be more concerned than ever to grasp the truth instead of wandering around saying you don't know anything. That's all I make of that point. In place of inference, I am more familiar with the term judgment. If one exists, may I have a distinction through definition? Well, inference and judgment are two entirely different concepts, as I understand them. Inference is the mental process of passing from one judgment to another, if you want to put it that way. A judgment, as I understand the term, is essentially synonymous with a proposition, a statement, a declaration that something is the case. I judge that all men are mortal. I judge that Socrates is a man. I judge that Socrates is mortal. And in older fashioned books, they're frequently called judgments instead of propositions or statements. But now, inference is a particular mental process which says, given certain judgments, given certain premises, given certain propositions, what else follows from them? It's the process of passing in thought from premises to a conclusion. So I don't see any relationship that would involve confusion between the two. Let me see, is this... Oh, this is a tissue, not a question. Excuse me. Do I have others? Yes.
If logic is the method by which one reasons, to what degree are the terms synonymous, and what more does reason include than logic?
The relation of the terms reason and logic. Well, as they frequently are used, reason is the much broader term, which means essentially the conceptual faculty. The faculty that man has as apart from the animals, which is not only the faculty of sense perception, but the ability to integrate sense perceptions conceptually. In that sense, you would say what sets man apart from the animals is the possession of reason, the faculty, the capacity, a certain type of consciousness, you see. Now, logic is a more specific term. Logic designates the method that is involved when you reason. When you reason, reasoning involves two elements: the use of concepts as against simply direct percepts, and the interconnection of those concepts by certain laws, namely logic. And therefore, you can say that reasoning is the conceptual grasp uniting your concepts by means of logic. So concepts are the elements which reason possesses. Logic is the method of interconnecting them. And the faculty which has that form of thought, conceptual, and uses this method, is reason. You see that reason is the broader term. Do I have others? Yes. You asked for the definition of the term proposition. I have no definition other than any assertion which claims to make a statement about reality in the connection with the logic course. That is, I would not, for purposes certainly of this course, distinguish between judgment, statement, proposition. I use them all as interchangeable for any statement which claims to be true, or for that matter, any statement which is established to be false. Others. Let me take one last look at some of these longer ones then to see if... Well, they're all quite wide. The only one I can see here offhand, I'll take them all home and look at them there. But the only one I can see offhand, it was just fairly tenuously connected to the course, but let's give it the benefit of the doubt. Is our society so irrational that we cannot rid our young of the many social socialists that teach in our American universities today? Well, what would you take as getting rid of them? The many socialists. Sure, there's a great many socialists, and you're not going to get rid of them overnight, but I would not say, I mean, the meaning of this question, the problem with this society is not that there are so many socialists teaching, but that there are so few pro-capitalists teaching. And the thing that will make the difference to the future is not getting rid of the socialists, because if you did that and simply replaced them with communist welfare statists, feudalists, theocrats, or absolute monarchs, or democrats, in quotes, for that matter, you'd be no further ahead. The problem is not getting rid of the socialists, but establishing the advocates of laissez-faire capitalism. And you would not have to even have the same numerical proportion. It could be 10 to 1 or 50 to 1 in the side of the socialists, and you'd still be all right. So the question should really be not how to get rid of the socialists, but how to establish the pro-capitalists, to which the only answer is the same way that the socialists got in. They did not suddenly appear out of the blue in mass quantity without any preparation or walk in and take over. In the United States, for instance, the socialists were a small band of dedicated intellectuals after the Civil War. For instance, the 1870s, the 1880s, they were completely at odds with the establishment. They were vilified by the pro-capitalist forces who were in control of the courts and the laws and to a large extent the colleges. Only the socialists were cashing in at that time on the accepted code of morality, the accepted philosophy, whereas the pro-capitalists had, so to speak, one foot in Aristotle and the other in Jesus, and they could not maintain that combination. The classic examples are John Stuart Mill, who started as an advocate of laissez-faire and ended up as a socialist, or Herbert Spencer, who didn't end up as a socialist, but was the most rabidly altruist writer, perhaps, in the whole history of thought. I read his Ethics recently, and I was stupefied at the extent of his advocacy of self-sacrifice, his truly medieval adulation of it. Now, if this is the base that the pro-capitalists had, then it's no wonder in any clash between ethics and politics, since politics is simply a derivative of ethics, necessarily ethics wins out. If everybody accepts the ethics of self-sacrifice and altruism, and a tiny band consistently advocates its political implementation, and the rest resist, given time and not too much time, it simply becomes an irresistible trend, and the so-called pro-capitalists just collapse. That's why the only answer to this question is you must establish a correct ethics. If you establish a valid individualist pro-reason ethics, an ethics of rational egoism, the socialism would collapse of its own weight. But of course, you're not going to establish an ethics out of the blue without an assault on all of the irrationalist doctrines on fundamental philosophic questions which underlay the altruist ethic, which means a whole proper system of philosophy. And therefore, the only answer to this question is you have to wage a fundamental philosophic campaign, one step of which is defending logic and being logical. That's how I bring it back, you see, to this course. And on that note, I will conclude for this evening. Thank you.